He often didn't come into the house, just sitting out on her gallery into the night, and she usually let him be. His behavior was so erratic that even she couldn't calm him some of the time. The screen door creaked in protest as she went outside. Joseph was sprawled in the rocking chair, his hand tightened around a piece of paper. He slept heavily, the sleep of the willfully numbed, or he had passed out. She would find out soon enough. Emily assumed he had suffered another disappointing trip to the lawyer. She gently shimmied the creased paper from his grip, a note written in his own cramped hand. The moonlight was too dim, so she left Joseph where he was and went back inside to light the kerosene lamp, letting the wick up high to make out the script on the page. The writing was alternately pinched and sprawling. Beale Landing, January 29, 1907. If I kill myself, it will be for the trouble that my wife has given me for 10 years. Bury me in my garden near the asparagus plants. I am tired of hearing her quarrels and abuses of me. I have worked hard and deprived myself to gain what I have, and today see that it has all become misfortune. I cannot understand for what reason she does not want my children to be around me or come to see me. I have no more life, no hope, so I might as well die or take my life. Without the children, I have nothing left in this world, not relatives, no friends. Those who I thought were friends have turned against me. Those who I thought would help me for my children's sake have banded together to refuse my wishes. My wife has been lost to me for several years. She has treated me lower than a Negro, which has caused my trouble until today, all because my children were colored. But I hope that the law will give them justice notwithstanding their color. I have not been able so far to guarantee their future as I had hoped. My wife knew that I had these children before I married her. She does not eat with me at the table and does not show any affection or understanding. She always has some excuse to give, and it is for this reason that I give up the fight, to end this life. It is better to have it end. Joseph Beale. Emily exhaled softly. Once more, to this. She went to the kitchen and set a pot of strong coffee to drip, and while waiting for the coffee to brew, she checked to make sure everyone else in the house was asleep, looking into their rooms as if they were still her little children to watch over. Mary, the youngest at 17, shared the bed with Josephine, 22, like two parts of a whole, even in sleep. Theo and Joe had both spent a full day at the sawmill and slept the deep sleep of exhaustion at the back of the house on the closed-in porch that served as their room. Her mother and grandmother shared the back bedroom, both snoring, one a soft whistle, the other a train straining uphill. Her family. The aroma of the coffee pulled her back to the kitchen. Emily tasted the hot, bitter brew, satisfied it was strong enough. She poured the coffee into two oversized mugs, sweetened them heavily with sugar, and took them out to the gallery. She set down the mugs, brought another chair from the house, and pushed at Joseph until he crossed to wakefulness. She stroked his grayed hair where it was thinnest. He leaned into her touch, as grateful as one of her cats. Finally he opened his eyes, and they sat and drank the strong brew in silence for a time. "I saw the letter," Emily said gently. "It's just my first copy," Joseph said, swirling the coffee slowly in the mug. "I'm really going to do it this time, Tit. But I couldn't without telling you first. I brought you more money." He pulled a thick packet wrapped in canvas from inside his jacket and handed it to her. His skin gave off a combination of stale tobacco, coffee, and liquor. "This is from my account in New Orleans," he continued. "No one here has any idea of how much I keep down there. I opened it separate from the business. I don't trust the Colfax Bank. They've shown they're against me and you.
Emily took the package, setting the bundle in her lap as Joseph leaned back in the chair, closing his eyes against the dark.
Joseph, what possible good comes from the things you talk about in this letter?
They can make me marry, but they can't make me live, Joseph said, eyes still closed. It all turns to dust anyway.
Your children still need you here.
The children are grown. There's nothing more I can do for them. They won't let me.
No one ever let you do anything, Joseph. Why grow faint now?
Joseph was quiet for a moment.
You remember Frank Rigsby, scratching out a living on his farm?
Emily felt a knot grow hard and cold deep in her stomach.
Of course, he took up with Sarah. They burned his house to the ground last night, and now he's disappeared. That wasn't an accident.
Is Sarah all right?
Emily was more frightened than she wanted to show. She knew there would be trouble the moment Rigsby moved Sarah in with him, a penniless white farmer and a Negro woman without standing.
You said it yourself. Rigsby was poor, without connection. He didn't have anything to fight back with, not like you.
Sarah is safe for now, back with her people. But you can't afford to put a good face on this tit. You have more to lose than anybody. How many times did they come to tell me to say, leave that colored woman alone? Rigsby was a fool for not listening, and Sarah is lucky she didn't go down in the fire. It could have gone much worse. It's impossible to fight them all, Tit. It's not just one or two. They drove Rigsby out, and nobody knows whether he's dead or alive, except that he's gone. That could have been us. 10 years ago.
The two of them sat, nursing their cold coffee.
I went to the lawyer again today, Joseph said. He said I don't have much of a chance, that I have to give it up.
Give up what? Emily asked.
Trying to pass my land to the children. He says it can't be done inside the law, that even if it was legal, the town wouldn't stand for it. He says only so much can be given because they're illegitimate. But it's really because of color. He won't help.
We couldn't marry, and now they say the children are illegitimate.
Emily shook her head wearily.
Joseph, my mother would say, that's the way of it. Now what do we do about it?
Threatening to kill yourself again isn't any answer.
This is all the more reason for you to stay around and take care of them.
You left me a long time ago for that woman, packed me up and carted me out of my own house. That is for you and me to carry between us. But who will be the children's father if you do this? I'm tired, Tit. It's too hard.
Emily sat upright in her chair, her back no longer touching the supports. Her voice was even, but her coffee spilled as she set the mug down too hard on the small table between the two chairs.
You're tired. You're the one who's tired?
She brought her face up close to Joseph's.
You don't have the right. You're the one in the big house on the landing, stealing down here when you have a need. The girls wait for you to come around as if you're a beau instead of their father. They're of the age when they should be finding men of their own. But they're too good for the Negroes, and are up to the standards of the whites. Theo and Joe Jr. come home at night with, Papa did this, Papa did that, full of dreams. They need you to clear a way for them through the banks and the railroads, the sawmill and the courts. You have a duty to your children.
Joseph ran his fingers through his thinning hair.
Listen, Tit. There's no more to be done. I tried. You have this land and the house. No one can take that away. I've made out a will leaving everything to my nephew. He'll make sure you are all taken care of. Lola won't get anything, and my brothers won't either.
Do you think I care who won't get something? All I care about is giving your own flesh and blood a better chance. We need you here. You're quick to trust Antoine's son, when Antoine has been so set against us all along. I know you love the children, Joseph, and you have to help them now, even if it makes it harder for you.
They've been to see me. The Night Riders.
Joseph gave a helpless shrug.
You'll be safer if I'm not here.
Are you thinking of me now?
Emily's eyes flashed hot, and the money bag slipped from her lap. Stacks of paper money spilled out on the cypress boards of the gallery. She left it there.
You write a full note saying you're going to kill yourself, and I'm not even in it. All you talk about is your precious white wife and how she treats you. Was I just a servant to you all those years? Bearing your children, running the store, making a home? You loved me once. When did that play out?
Joseph placed his hand on Emily's, but she batted it away and used it to gather the money back into the canvas bag.
That's one thing that will never change, Joseph said. You know that, Tit. I was stronger once, but they've threatened all of you unless I let the will go.
Think, really think about your children. In my family, we don't share all of our stories, but it's easy enough to fill in the gaps, full of white men who left and the colored women who took over the children. Left for France, left for marriage. Angélique was the last to act it out.
Emily set the canvas bag on the gallery planks and took one of Joseph's hands in hers.
After Jacques left, Angélique turned it inside out and married colored. The first in our family to have a marriage and a baby, both, one before the other. Maybe that's enough of an example to shape a change for the rest, but I don't think so. You left to marry someone else, Joseph, but you never left your children behind. Don't leave them now.
She poured more coffee from the pot for both of them, the dark liquid barely warm now.
I'm worried about Theo, she said, shifting her tone. There's something you should know.
You told me that you broke with Antoine, but your wife still meets him at the house. Antoine and somebody else Theo didn't recognize.
How could Theo know that?
That's why I'm worried, Emily said. He's been hanging around that house without you knowing for years. You need to help the boy get on with his own life.
He's hardly a boy, Joseph said. He's 26 years old, and you tell me he spies on me? How long have you known this?
I didn't until he told me today, but I can't say I'm entirely surprised. Your leaving hit him harder than any of the others. He worshipped you.
I know. Joseph held his head in his hands. Lola never said a word about seeing Antoine. He has no business at the house anymore.
I thought it might be important.
Emily pulled her shawl tighter around her shoulders.
Joseph, about the will. If you made one, you can make another. Go see some other lawyer outside the parish, but don't tell anyone here you're still trying to leave the land to the children. I know how fond you are of Antoine's son, but I don't trust that family.
I should be able to do as I please with my own money, Joseph said.
That's not the world we live in.
Bring me some paper, Tit, he said finally.
Emily went into the house and returned with a lamp, a page of Beale Lumber Company stationery, and a pen.
You can take back anything you said before, and put this one in its place, she said, as he handed the paper and pen to Joseph.
She looked over his shoulder as he drafted a new document.
Beale Landing, February 22nd,
1907. Today, I make my testament in my own hand, and I leave all that I have to my children and Antoine Morat, my nephew, in equal parts. My children are all recognized in the records of the courthouse that they were my children, and I gave to them 74 acres of land that day at the same time. I give them my money that they will find in the bank and elsewhere, and the property to be divided in equal parts. Joseph Beale.
This will is in French. It reads textually as follows. Beale's Landing, February 22nd, 1907.
Aujourd'hui, je fais mon testament de ma propre main, que je laisse tout ce que j'ai à mes enfants, et à Antoine Morat, mon neveu, à part égale. Mes enfants sont tous reconnus dans le record de Courthouse que c'était mes enfants, et je leur ai donné 74 acres of land en même temps. Je leur donne mon argent qu'ils trouveront en banque et ailleurs, et les propriétés à partage égale.
Signed, Joseph Beale.
They both read the note over, and Emily nodded. Go on home now, Joseph. Sleep in your own bed. No use making things any worse than they already are. If you start to lose your nerve, remember the ones you leave behind. Theo, Joseph, Josephine, Mary. You can find another lawyer tomorrow, when you feel stronger, and have him hold the note for safekeeping.
You have to believe me, Tite,
Joseph said, squeezing her hand so tightly that it began to hurt. I'm willing to lose the last drop of blood I have for my children.
Chapter 41.
A cold, steady rain fell, and from the look of the dark clouds across the night sky and the smell of the woods, it could keep up until morning. Theo pulled his jacket tighter across his slender shoulders. The greyness of February had pressed in from early morning, and the night added its own oppressive dimension. Although the route was familiar through the dripping piney woods to his father's house, a tightness deep in his chest convinced Theo something terrible was in the making. Even after the shameful confession to his mother, after his promise that he would stop the visits, here he was again, after only one day. But he was the eyes and ears for his family, and trouble was closing in from every direction. Joseph Beale was the center of a storm brewing. His threats to find a way to leave his money to his children had caused the resistance to him to grow more forceful. Whispers and grumblings, yielding to open discussions about moral depravity infecting the community. White people were angry, speaking openly to protest, and it didn't seem possible things could go on at the same pitch much longer. The changes in tone started back when the evenings were still warm and the collected heat of the day turned sun-baked houses into ovens. Folks kept to their galleries late, sitting, talking, occupying themselves the best they could. The warm night air easily lifted their words and carried them to Theo. Now, in the cold, damp fogs of an extended winter, he had to prowl ever closer. Theo circled around the back of the house on Beale Landing, and as he approached, angry, insistent voices pressed past the drizzle and hung on the windless air. Since last summer, through fall and into winter's cool grip, Lola and Joseph argued all of the time, without caution or reserve. Every word they exchanged was charged, and between them there seemed to be only silence or explosive irritation. Whatever truce they had fashioned over the years had unraveled beyond repair. Theo crept even closer, crouching on the sodden ground just under the window at the side of the house, his boots caked with sticky, rust-colored mud. Lola's voice was raised, wounded, but crystal clear.
I may have been deceived in the beginning by your assurances of reform, but you are utterly incapable and indisposed to make a change in the manner of life you led before. It is only in the presence of your mulatto children and their shameless mother that you are civil, or so I hear. Is that where you were last night?
You never try to understand me, making only the most feeble of attempts to live with me as a wife.
Joseph's voice was distracted, almost offhand, as if this were an old dance and he was duty-bound to perform the obligatory steps. Theo heard the drink behind the words.
The only reason you married me, Lola said, control gone from her voice, was to protect yourself from the townspeople. You courted me and married me just to better your position in a community that had rejected you for your wickedness.
It was my money you were after, Joseph said. No other man would have you.
What good is the money to me? You are so stingy I never benefit. I don't even have servants.
You have no call for complaint. You don't sit to table with me. You have run off my friends with your airs. You never made me welcome in the bedroom.
Coward!
Lola dangled the word, thick and accusing, her voice slightly unsteady, and Theo realized she too had been drinking.
Using me because you are afraid for your own personal safety. You never meant to put aside your colored family.
You knew about the children from the beginning,
Joseph said tiredly.
You pretended to take me, children and all.
How often do you sneak over to Confine Bayou to see that mulatto woman and her mongrels? Do you suppose you can use your money to place those children somehow into decent society? I married a fool. It can never happen.
I want them to inherit what it took my whole life to earn, the way any father would.
There was passion building in Joseph's voice now.
You are cold and uncharitable, unable to grasp flesh and blood needs.
Fidelity and support is your obligation under the law, and you have given me neither. 10 years as your wife means it is I who should inherit. You forced me to sign back the land donation you gave before we married, and I did so because you were my husband, entitled to obedience. No one explained my rights to me then, but your shameful conduct now forfeits all such respect.
You were never forced, Joseph said quietly. You gave back the land donation in front of witnesses. It is far too late to change that now.
Lola began to cry.
I am alone and friendless in the middle of nowhere, she said between sobs. I want to move into town. I cannot go on living in this house.
I built this house and made too many sacrifices to tolerate this contempt of your life in it. It wouldn't be proper for you to live alone in town, and I have no intention of moving.
There are people willing to help me, Lola said thinly, tears gone. I am not as defenseless as you imagine.
Have you been putting our business before strangers, Lola?
The whole town talks about us. And what to do about the evil you have brought in their midst? I am a church-going Catholic woman, virtuous and honest, and I am tired of being exposed to the lowest creatures on this earth. I have been too shamed and too humiliated before now to publish to the world my unhappiness, and unwilling to give up my profound religious duty as a wife.
Other wives take care of their men. You could learn a lesson from that.
I performed 4 years as best I could under the circumstances, but the good people of the community are not going to stand by quietly any longer.
I will leave the land to my children, the only ones who bring me happiness.
Lola's voice firmed.
You seek happiness no place else, preferring the company of Negroes over decent people, trying to pull me down too. But I will not let you do it.
You mean less than nothing to me.
There was a pause between the two of them, as if the exhalation of the one's vicious breath needed time to provide fuel for the other's response.
The children you set such store by are an abomination before God, Lola said. the oldest girl just like her mother, taking up with any Frenchman she could entice with her free and easy ways, producing babies without a husband, without decency. Too bad the little nigger bastard survived. And the oldest boy, timid, afraid of his own shadow, hanging off your every word. No wonder you are so fond of them all. They are the only ones who look up to you.
Lola's words entered Tio like poison, contempt and loathing so strong and thick that it passed through the walls of the house on Veal Landing and directly under his skin, full strength. Tio turned away from the house. Their fighting filled him with dread instead of soothing him. Soaked through, he retraced his steps toward Cornfine Bayou, stumbling repeatedly on the tangled undergrowth that pulled from below. Distracted, he almost didn't hear the approach of horsemen coming through the woods at first, until they were almost on him. There were at least two riders, and he heard the nearby snort of a hard-ridden horse as one of the riders stopped in the path he had been getting ready to take. Tio eased himself behind the base of a wide oak tree, pressing his back into the damp trunk, closing his eyes against the rain.
"Hold up. I don't want to go any farther. Can't we do this another way?"
It was Antoine Morat. Tio recognized the voice at once. He was careful not to move, willing himself invisible, slowing his breathing to drive the pounding from his ears.
"You've waited a little late to go soft."
Tio didn't recognize the voice of the other man.
"I tell you, I can't do it," Antoine said.
"What happened to your big talk? The old Frenchman brought it on himself, carrying on the way he has. That land rightly belongs in your hands, the right hands. Have you forgotten your own son's needs so quickly?"
"But Lola wasn't supposed to be part of this," Antoine said.
"There's no other way. Otherwise, it all reverts to her. Do I have to remind you how much you need the money? And now him making all this trouble about the inheritance, cutting you out entirely. He's laughing at us. There isn't a respectable man anywhere in these parts who would excuse his behavior with the colored woman."
"I tell you, I just can't do it. He's my cousin."
"By the time you get your nerve up, there won't be anything left to fight for. I can't hold him off forever from finding a means to pass the land the way he wants. Meanwhile, he's selling off bits and pieces of the property to the railroad, and Lola and the rest of the Grand Champs have their hands out, too, expecting a share."
"Lola thinks she's in with us."
"There's no helping that now."
"I won't do it. We'll go and talk to him. Make him see reason."
"The old fool is too bullheaded to reason, or we wouldn't have had to come this far. We're beyond talk. Let's go. We need to get it done."
Tio caught the sour odor of his own fear leaking out in his sweat. They were headed out to his father's place. He should follow them. And do what? This was a matter for the law, so only White could help. He couldn't get tangled up in White business without hanging himself somehow. He would have to explain why he was out in the woods, how he happened to overhear the conversation. He wouldn't be believed and would end up being blamed for something. Tio shook, wet and weak against the tree, caught in indecision long after the riders had gone. At last he straightened up and began to move with as much of a sense of purpose as his legs would allow. Chapter 42. Tio was so jittery that he made Emily nervous as they worked side by side in the garden, tying back the string bean vines. High-strung like his father. When Tio had refused to go to the sawmill this morning with his brother Joe for the second day in a row, Emily put him to work around the farm, thankful he wasn't out snooping around Beale Landing. She was convinced he was keeping something from her. The weekend had come and gone. She hadn't heard yet from Joseph, and she was worried. She had lived through Joseph's black moods before, and the sooner he found a new lawyer and proved to himself he was in control of his own affairs, the sooner he would break out of the grip of despair that held him fast. Emily heard the horses before she saw them, and was surprised to see her son Joe riding with the sheriff and several other men toward the house. Something was very wrong. They must have gone by the sawmill first to get Joe and bring him back to Cornfine Bayou. The men tethered their horses at the side of the house and dismounted. Emily threw Joe a questioning look, and Joe lifted his shoulders slightly, signaling that he didn't know what this was about either.
"We're here on official business," the sheriff said to Emily. "Here to talk to everyone in your house."
"Go collect the girls and Mama Philomène," Emily said to Theo. To the men, she said, "Let's go inside." The sheriff, a heavy-set man with a doughy face and stubborn stubble, followed Emily to the front room, sitting on the far end of the same couch where Suzette half lay, half sat, a quilt tucked neatly around the lower half of her body. This was Suzette's regular day place, surrounded by a small pile of socks and other garments waiting to be darned or patched. The sheriff's circle of men continued to stand. Although it was only mid-morning, the sheriff looked as if he were at the end of a particularly long day. As they waited, he glanced at the oil painting hanging over the mantel. A flickering question registered briefly in his eyes and disappeared again. Philomène and the girls entered the house quietly, stray bits of hay still clinging to their clothes. Theo followed. Barely subdued panic flooded the faces of both girls. They stood along the wall in a tight clump, and Mary took Josephine's hand. There wasn't a single rustle or cough, and the sheriff seemed to wait over long for a silence already descended in the room. Finally he turned to Emily.
"There's been an occurrence out on Beale Landing," he said, speaking in English. "Joseph Beale and Lola Grandchamp are dead."
There was a collective gasp that met in the middle of the room, impossible to separate into individual sound, belonging to each of them. The sheriff paused, judging reaction to the news, looking boldly from one face to another, making no attempt to disguise his scrutiny.
"On Saturday night or Sunday morning, Joseph Beale killed his wife by shooting her in the back, and then turned a gun on himself," the sheriff said. "I have a list of questions, the same questions we're asking all his neighbors and relevant acquaintances."
Emily had trouble keeping up, already a beat behind trying to translate the sheriff's English words to French. She had just seen Joseph, touched the warmth of his cheek, stroked his hair. Joseph dead? It couldn't be true. She exchanged the briefest of glances with Philomène. Her mother's face was impassive, but her gaze reached across to steady Emily. Joseph wouldn't have murdered Lola, or turned the gun on himself. But if Joseph and Lola were dead, someone would have to pay. Was it someone in this house they had chosen? Emily steeled herself against the endless possibilities of what could turn dangerous because of these white men in her house.
"Joseph, he's dead?"
She couldn't stop herself from asking, although it was as much a statement as question. The sheriff nodded, then made a small beckoning motion with his hands. One of his other men brought forward a sloppily wrapped bundle and handed it to the sheriff.
"Evidence collected at the scene of the crime," he said.
He unfolded the cloth to reveal an old-style French pistol, a Winchester rifle with a dark walnut stock, and a large pocket knife. Why were there so many different weapons? Emily had to pull her eyes away from the objects in front of her. The French pistol was Joseph's. The rifle and knife were not. The sheriff addressed himself to the Beale men.
"Do you recognize this pistol as belonging to Joseph Beale?" he asked.
The brothers looked from one to the other.
"Just answer the questions, boys."
Emily saw Tio's eyes go soft and silently willed him to stay strong.
"No, sir. I never saw that gun before."
Tio's voice had fled to a whisper.
"I don't recognize it either, sir," Joe said.
Then the questions came in rapid succession. "How about the rifle? Have you seen the knife before? How often did Joseph Beale drink whiskey? How much? Would you consider him a drunk? When did you see him last? Did he seem troubled or bothered? Did he seem a rational man or a desperate one?"
"I haven't seen my father since Christmas," Tio said. "He seemed fine then."
"I saw him last Wednesday," Joe admitted. "I borrowed a team of his oxen to do some hauling, but we didn't talk long. There was nothing different than usual."
The sheriff turned to Emily and repeated the same questions, as if he were already bored with them. In spite of the swift deadening of her mind and the clawing beast housed in her chest, she gave the same answers as her sons. She moved through her exchanges with the law as if they were dancing a slow waltz.
"Yes, I used to live on the Beale place and was moved away by Joseph Beale. Yes, I was a neighbor and friendly as such with both Mr. and Mrs. Beale. No, I don't know whether he was in any way troubled. No, I can't remember ever seeing this pistol or that rifle or a knife. No, I don't know what went on between Joseph and his wife, Lola."
As she spoke, conscious of Philomène's steady gaze, Emily felt the force of her mother's voice deep inside her brain. Deny. There were real questions, and the men in her front room didn't seem interested in asking them. Who could have really done this thing? Caution. What ugly repayment was this for the choices she and Joseph had made? Calm. She wanted to defend Joseph, defend herself, convince these men how impossible it was to think Joseph shot Lola in the back, or himself. Grief has to wait. The white men in her front room seemed easily satisfied with the answers and began to shift restlessly, impatient to get away. Even the sheriff's heart wasn't in it. His eyes kept drifting back to the oil painting. At last the sheriff rose.
"We don't require any more answers at this time, but we might have to come back later," he said.
It didn't seem as though they were on a search to lay blame at Cornfine Bayou, and they didn't bother to question the girls or Suzette and Philomène. The men mounted their horses and left. Only when the pine trees cancelled the sight and sounds of their visitation completely did Emily sit down to cry. The news traveled like wildfire from the bottoms to the hills, in the towns and back in the country, even into the most remote recesses of the piney woods. But it was Edfred Dieu who brought the first newspaper article out to Cornfine Bayou. Narcisse's white son often came to visit, a part of the melange of extended kinfolk, black and white, that collected under Emily's roof each Sunday. He pulled the newspaper out of his saddlebag and folded it under his coat jacket as soon as he got off his horse. The house was bustling and full, as it was every Sunday, and he waited for an opportunity to pull Emily aside.
"I brought the newspaper for you," Ed said in low tones. "I wasn't sure whether you wanted to be alone with the news or not."
Emily studied her half-brother, full of good intentions.
"Just wait long enough for everyone to get here, and then read it out loud for all to hear," she said.
They gathered in the front room before Sunday dinner. Cousins, sister, nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, grandparents, grandchildren. In a shamed voice, Ed read the newspaper account of the murder-suicide described to Emily by the sheriff 4 days before. Ed finished reading and gingerly laid the newspaper on the small table in the front room, as if it were a breakable thing. There was silence. The Colfax Chronicle, Saturday, March 2nd, 1907. A horrible tragedy. Joseph Beale and wife found dead. Beale is supposed to have killed his wife and then committed suicide. One of the most terrible double tragedies that ever occurred in Grant Parish was discovered at the home of Mr. Joseph Beale last Tuesday morning. The discovery was made by Mr. Adolphe Dubois, who rode up to the gate for the purpose of getting permission to pen some oxen in Mr. Beale's pasture. He discovered the body of Mrs. Beale lying in the yard and called for help, but receiving no answer, he rode over to a neighbor's house and gave the alarm. Mrs. Beale was found in her nightclothes with a pistol bullet through her body. A posse of citizens broke open the house, which they found securely locked and barred from the inside, and discovered the body of Mr. Joseph Beale lying on the bed, his throat cut and two gunshot wounds in his head. Sheriff Swafford and several citizens of Colfax went to the scene of the tragedy, which is on Red River, 12 miles north of this place, at what is known as Beale Landing. A coroner's jury was impaneled by Magistrate L. J. O'Neill, assisted by Dr. J. L. Woodall, and sat into the night making investigations. Being unable to arrive at a satisfactory verdict, the jury adjourned over until Thursday. Mr. Beale, who was a native of France, was about 65 years of age, and his wife was about 60. She was a Miss Lola Grandchamp, and they were married at Cloutierville, Natchitoches Parish, 6 or 7 years ago. Beale conducted a store about 1 mile south of the mouth of Bayou Nantashi for about 20 years, and had accumulated a great deal of property. He quit merchandising several years ago, and has been giving his attention mainly to his landed interests, having lately sold his timber lands for a large sum of money. He had raised a Negro family in that locality by a mulatto woman, and as he and his wife did not get along peaceably, it is thought they were a matter of rupture between Beale and his wife, leading possibly to the terrible tragedy. The mulatto woman and her several children were moved to another house, and Beale and his wife lived in his old home by themselves, not even having any servants. They had no children, and the nearest neighbors are said to have lived a quarter, possibly a half mile away. The coroner's jury was composed of the following citizens: I. McCain, L. Calhoun, C. G. Gwynn, W. L. Doughty, and B. E. Woods. At their sitting on Thursday, they decided that Mrs. Beale came to her death from a rifle bullet fired into her back by her husband, and that Joseph Beale killed himself. The dead man's watch and pocketbook, with a small amount of money in it, were found undisturbed. He had been drinking a good deal of late to the point of delirium. The theory is that Mrs. Beale was killed Saturday night or Sunday, and that after killing her, Beale locked himself in the house and decided to kill himself. That he first shot himself with his pistol, the ball passing under his jaw and out near his temple without reaching a vital spot, and lodging in the ceiling overhead. That he afterward tried to cut his throat, severing his windpipe half in two, but being unable on account of the dullness of his knife or his weakness and nervousness to cut the jugular veins, and that he then seized his Winchester and, placing it under his chin, fired a ball through his head, managing in his death struggle to fall across the bed before life left his body. Mrs. Beale must have laid out in the yard during the rain of Sunday evening and night. The bloody finger marks and footprints about the room, and the streams and pools of blood, and the weapons with their crimson, ghastly stains, are said to sustain the theory of the jury's finding. The remarkable thing that these two bodies should have lain for 3 or 4 days without discovery is hard to comprehend. Also, the uncertainty as to the motive for the crime leaves a murky mystery, and there are lingering suspicions that, after all, it may be a horrible double murder, carefully planned and concealed by some fiend incarnate bent on robbing the old man of his coveted wealth. Emily knew that there was no use fighting. What with a newspaper article shamelessly making the claim that Joseph had shot himself in the head with a pistol, cut his own throat, and then come back to shoot himself in the face with a rifle. There would be no true investigation. The town was invested in the sheriff's account, and to seek a different explanation for the events on Beale Landing would undermine the collective relief that justice had at last been done. Joseph was dead. There was nothing more to do about that. It almost didn't matter which one pulled back on the trigger or applied pressure to the blade. It was the acting out of the town's desire, finally snaring Joseph when his offense was over a decade gone. Caught because he tried to leave his children, money, and land. Emily felt a hand pushing at the small of her back, moving her, and she found herself no longer in the front room, but seated at the dining table, looking up at Philomène.
"We are not bringing this mess to our table," Philomène said, taking hold of the room's quiet gloom. "They print up anything that comes into their heads. Dinner is ready, and we aren't going to let good food go to waste. Theo, we're short a seat. Bring up another chair and put it at the children's table."
The next Sunday, Theo read aloud from a soiled, torn-out strip of newsprint. He said he'd found it in the New Orleans paper. "A statement found today in the effects of Joseph Beale, the wealthy old Frenchman who last week shot and killed his wife and suicided at their home in Beale Landing, near here, indicates that the double tragedy was deliberately planned. The statement, which is signed by Beale, relates that should he be found dead at any time, the end was to be attributed to an unhappy life with his wife. Beale also censured a prominent attorney of this section. The statement was written in French and dated January 29th of this year." New Orleans Times, Picayune, March 4th, 1907. Emily's carefully hoarded reserve of energy drained away. Joseph had never destroyed his supposed suicide note, as she had done with so many others over the years. Now they used it as evidence that he'd planned to kill himself and Lola all along.
"I don't know where you got that paper," Emily said to Theo, "but I hope you will have the good sense to keep to yourself and not provoke anyone. We all have to be especially cautious now. When the time comes, Mama, I'll get us our inheritance."
There was a fever glint to his eyes that made Emily fearful of how indiscreet her son could allow himself to be. That evening, Emily brought hot sassafras tea to Philomène and Suzette. Suzette was fighting her third infection of the winter, confined to her bed, and Philomène sat with her.
"You look tired, daughter. Come sit with us."
Philomène smoothed a place on the bed near her chair.
"I think I will sit for a few minutes," Emily said. "I seem always so close to exhaustion or weeping these days."
As if to prove the point, her eyes moistened, but she closed them for a long moment to hold back the tears. Philomène sweetened the tea for all three of them.
"Is it that article in the newspaper?"
"I suppose." Emily's thoughts were sluggish. "There's no talking back to the page. People can present truth however they like. That article today makes clear that they found two documents. It wasn't until the second note that he censured the attorney. But they didn't mention one word of his wishes to leave half of his estate to the children. Only the suicide note. Someone still walking among us, Kid Joseph and Lola both. I'm just thankful you were not a part of it," Philomène said. "That's the truth that matters. The only thing to do now is stay out of the way until the blood appetite passes. We have everything we need right here on the farm."
Emily shrugged. "It seems so hopeless. Joseph dead, and Theo with his manhood wrapped so tight to an inheritance he'll never see."
Suzette suddenly grew frantic, gesturing Emily closer.
"You have family to look after," she whispered. "Throw down pride and go to the white man. It's the only way."
"To ask for what, Mémère?" asked Emily.
"Freedom."
It took several moments for Emily to understand that Suzette had gone back in her mind to the past. Emily nodded weakly, patting Suzette's hand reassuringly, as again she fought back tears. Philomène was tight-lipped. They both stayed with Suzette until she fell into a ragged sleep.
keep Theo from going into Colfax, Philomène said to Emily as they got up to go to bed. He's asking for trouble. His is the same talk that got Joseph dead.
They couldn't get enough of the story in town. Each day brought some new speculation, some new piece of evidence that proved once and for all that Joseph Beale had gotten exactly what he deserved. They were divided down the middle on whether he killed himself or not, whether he murdered his wife. For each fact that supported one side, there seemed to be another that fed the arguments of the opposing camp. The first doctor on the scene had written a report stating that no man, drunk or sober, could have sustained so many wounds by his own hand and still have the strength to cut his own throat. The suicide note that his lawyer produced 2 days after the discovery of the bodies was indisputably in Joseph's own hand. Those who knew him and those who didn't debated whether Joseph was a drunk, whether he was a violent bully or a fun-loving man, a devilish fellow full of high spirits, or just a devil. There was, however, little disagreement that whatever the instrument, he had reaped what he had sown. There was little talk of Lola. She had come too late to the margins of the town to hold as the centerpiece for the tragedy. Her family had no strong ties this side of Red River, and she was more a curiosity, a fuzzy detail, an unwitting accomplice in her own dark fate. The most popular of all the stories going the rounds was of the wailing, ragtag mulatto family being dragged out of Joseph's home and loaded into wagons so the new wife could move into the same house the next day. With each telling, the family got larger, the confrontation between white and colored more violent, the more eyewitnesses who had always known what Joseph Beale was capable of. Lola seemed to have faded from view, eclipsed by the magnitude of the lesson still to be taught, a backdrop for the real story of moral decay and depravity. By the second week, the murder had been replaced as the front-page story of the Colfax Chronicle, but within the inner sections of the thin tabloid, beside the main advertisements and land sale notifications, Theo found an editorial and brought it back to Cornfine Bayou. He read aloud to the family. The Colfax Chronicle, Saturday, March 9th, 1907. The Sin of Miscegenation. The race question, which has agitated the United States and especially the Southern states, has lately been shown up with the distinctness of an awful tragedy in Grant Parish. We refer to the death of the Frenchman Joseph Beale and his wife, an account of which was published in the Chronicle last week. It develops from a letter or statement found among the effects of Beale, written in French, that he killed his wife and then committed suicide. This is the tragic end of a white man who committed the crime against his race of raising a family of mixed Negro blood. Joseph Beale was the last remaining representative of 5 white men who 15 and 20 years ago lived within a few miles of Colfax in open concubinage with Negro women or their quadroon offspring. His consort or paramour was the daughter of Narcisse Frédieu by a mulatto woman. Beale took up with her, and the couple lived together as man and wife, raising a family of several children. In the course of time, Beale, by the help of this woman, who was frugal and helpful, and was really of comely appearance, amassed a pretty fair fortune. Finding that his mongrel family was a matter of reproach to him among the white people, and prevented his mingling among them upon terms of social equality, Beale decided it was best for him to get himself a pure-blooded Caucasian wife. Some 8 or 10 years ago, he was legally married to Miss Lola Grandchamp, a spinster maid of about 50 years, and his concubine and her children had to be forcibly removed from the house before his legal white wife could take possession. The wife proved exacting and objected to the constant exhibitions of affection which Beale manifested for his offspring and their mother who lived nearby, and were maintained by the bounty of the father. No children blessed his legal wife, and the illegitimate children were a constant cause of strife, and so the matter grew from bad to worse. His affection for the offspring of his youth and their mother grew upon him, and he wanted them to have his property. He consulted his attorney, and was told his illegitimate children could not inherit his estate. but only a portion of it could be devised them by will, and that only in a particular way. He brooded over the matter, and in the French writing left by him, said it seemed that he had descended so low as to be no better than a negro. This sheds a glare of light on the tragedy, and shows the frenzy into which he had worked himself to commit the terrible deed, by which he seems to have vainly imagined he could atone for the wrong done his innocent offspring, and palliate the crime against the white race. In Letters of Blood, he has left written the inexorable law of the Southland, that the taint of the inferior race forever debars admission into the social precincts of the Caucasian home. Let us hope and pray that poor Beale is to be the last in this parish that will ever follow in this footpath of evil.
According to this paper, Joseph's crime wasn't in having a colored family. It was in raising them, Philomène said when Theo finished reading. There was more disgust and acknowledgement than anger in her voice. Her eyes darted from face to face. We put this behind us today. We keep to ourselves, hold on to the land we have, and go about our business.
He wanted us to have his property,
Theo shouted, almost a pure bellow of pain at the end. He slapped his open hand on the table so hard that the newspaper slid to the floor.
It says so right here. They admitted it.
Theo, let it go, Emily said gently. Theo faced his mother directly, breathing hard.
You said to let it go when he moved us from our house. You said there was plenty of time for me to be a man. That time is now. We can't just let him go like this.
Don't be foolish, Emily said harshly. Why do you think Joseph is lying in the cold ground? As soon as he started to talk about inheritance, it was set. This isn't over yet. The white folks will fight over that land. But there won't be anything more for us. You want to do something, Theo? Find out Antoine Morat's plans. He's the one speaking for the estate.
Theo quickly drew his hand to his face, but not before Emily saw the muscle below her son's left eye begin to twitch uncontrollably. Chapter 43. Theo was the protector of his family now, and it was his place to go. He found Antoine at the mill.
"Can I speak to you, Monsieur Antoine?"
Theo asked above the noise of the grinder.
"Not now, boy," Antoine yelled back.
His bland face was composed, as if there were no surprise in the request.
"Come around to my house after supper this evening."
Theo waited for over an hour in Antoine's backyard before he heard the approaching crunch of boots on soil.
"That's too bad about your papa," Antoine said. "What is it you want to talk to me about, boy?"
Theo backed away a small step and took a deep breath. "Joseph Beale wanted us to have the land, Monsieur Antoine. He told us it was our inheritance. They say you're the one looking over it. That's all we want." Antoine laughed, a long, loud laugh.
"That's all you want? 2,000 acres of timberland, or what's left? That's all you want? Your papa was a murderer, and your mama raised a fool who doesn't know his place." "He didn't kill anyone," Theo said. "They can say whatever they want, but somebody else was there that night."
Antoine's smile faded.
"You can be a smart boy and turn around and go on back home to your mama, or you can end up like Joseph Beale. It isn't in you to be brave, boy. I see to it you come out of this just fine, you and your family. Hell, I'm godfather to your brother. I have your best interests at heart. It's what Joseph would have wanted."
Antoine spat a stream of tobacco juice into the dirt at his feet.
"You'll never go hungry. But you put aside this loose talk about inheritance and land. You don't know what you're up against, boy. Nobody wants to see you or your family hurt. It's over now. Closed."
"I saw you," Theo said.
Antoine didn't change expression, but turned to face Theo squarely.
"Just what is it you think you saw, boy?" I saw you going up to Beale Landing that night.
The admission tasted strange on Tio's tongue. He had told no one about what he had seen in the woods before now.
Nobody is interested in what you think you saw, boy. I heard you with another man, Tio said, light-headed.
Antoine considered Tio carefully.
Let's say you did see me that night. What of it? If you're trying to say I'm the one who killed Joseph Beale and his wife, you're crazy. A white man could testify against me in court, even though he would be mistaken. But now, that's not you, is it?
He sounded almost curious.
What has gotten into you?
Tio's stomach burned. He knew the smart thing to do, but couldn't make himself retreat.
He wanted the land to go to us.
Antoine didn't try to hide his disbelief or his anger.
It's your choice now. You repeat what you just said to anyone else, and I promise the whole lot of you will go. That's a promise. From the old lady to the baby, fire burns hot and hides everything. I don't want to hear one more word about where I was that night. You don't have any rights, boy. I'm all that standing between you and sure disaster. Now I'm tired of this. I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to go back to your mama, and you're going to praise me for not taking away the little bit you already have. I still have to straighten out Joseph's affairs in court. I'll do right by you, and you'll do right by me. You will never talk about that night again to anyone, including me. Is that what you plan to do next?
Tio felt hollow.
Oui, Monsieur Morat. I didn't hear you, boy. Oui, Monsieur Morat.
That's better.
Go on. Get on off my property while I'm still feeling generous.
Chapter 44. Although Emily seldom left Cornfine Bayou, visitors brought word of the strange unfolding of testimony as one court proceeding followed another for months. Witnesses swore to Joseph Beale's temperament, his drinking, his intentions, his treatment of Lola, his colored family, and an earnest parade of supporters and detractors canceled each other out. As far as Emily was concerned, it was only the land they fought over. The two challengers in the courtroom were Antoine Morat on the one side and Lola Grandchamp's heirs on the other. In recent memory, from Montgomery to Colfax, there had been no story this exciting, no events firing so much speculation. Most had heard of the old Frenchman back in the woods, who for so many years lived openly with his mulatto family, bringing them under his own roof, in the end coming to his senses to marry white. As the trials wore on, Joseph Beale became an object lesson, useful when parents lectured their children about the consequences of race mixing or the inevitable aftermath of giving in to temptation. He became the topic of sermons on reaping and sowing, and the subject of a series of editorials in the Colfax Chronicle on the evils of miscegenation. Eventually on Cornfine Bayou, they lost touch with the daily proceedings from the courthouse and settled back into farm life. Everyday issues crowded out the unreality and distance of the trials in Colfax. Suzette fell into ill health again in the worst of the season's heat and developed a deep cough that wouldn't ease. She hovered between sickness and recovery all summer, and they all did their best to make her comfortable. 6 months after Joseph was killed, late one muggy evening, Emily dragged her rocking chair out to the front gallery to join Philomène. They sat and rocked to the hypnotic clicking of crickets' music carried on the still air.
"I loved him, Mama," Emily said out of nowhere.
"I know," said Philomène. She crocheted a white lace doily for the whatnot table, looping thread around her hooked needle and pulling it through itself in quick, expert motions.
"He was all you ever knew."
"If they had just left us alone," Emily said, "we weren't hurting anyone. First they killed the us in him and me, and then they killed him to make a lesson of it. All he wanted was to settle into old age surrounded by his children. He never would have left them, no matter how much he threatened, no matter if he wrote 1,000 notes.
The weight of the ongoing trials had exhausted Emily, although she'd played no part.
They took him away twice.
Philomène stilled the rocking of her moonlight chair and lowered her crochet needle to her lap.
Daughter, flesh and blood men killed Joseph, not they. It gets too hard to figure out what you need to do next until you bring it back around to particulars.
She took up her crocheting again.
No one was ever strong enough to kill what the two of you shared.
Emily nodded, but the shadows of the night wouldn't release her thoughts of Joseph and all they had lost.
What people say about him at the trials, that he was fun or nervous or devilish or stingy, each one got it right and got it wrong too. They saw him from the outside and offered up one piece of the man at a time, like it was the whole cloth. He was more than that.
We need to get this family pointed to the future, Philomène said. There's no bringing Joseph back. You're still here, safe, and that's a blessing.
The lone screeching of a hoot owl filled the night, and then fell quiet.
I can't speak of him anymore, Emily whispered, and the admission hurt her. I can't speak his name out loud.
Whatever allows you to get up and go on another day. You are left with more than you think. The children have his name, and that matters, Philomène said. And there's the money.
Emily collected herself.
Almost $2,000 in cash, hidden safe around the house and yard. The Colfax Bank refused Joe's petition for a loan to expand his lumber operations, and I've been thinking about backing him. But by rights, Theo, as the oldest, should come first.
Philomène stopped the motion of her rocker again.
We have to be careful how we spend money. Joe has a gift with timber, men, and numbers, same as Joseph, and big dreams. 6 men already and more work than he can handle. Use a piece of the money for him now, and in due time, it will come back to us. As for Theo, money isn't what he needs.
Emily sighed. These trials are eating him up, following each detail night and day like a man possessed. He's lost so much weight that his clothes hang on him. I want to help him pass this, but Theo's hiding something. And the truth is, I can't bear to hear any more about the proceedings.
Theo will find his way in time, Philomène said, but he can't put himself into anything now but the idea of bringing back a lost inheritance.
I'll give Joe the money tomorrow, said Emily.
It can't seem to come from us, said Philomène. We have to make it look like he gets his backing from outside the parish. Joe can go to New Orleans and open a bank account with the cash, and then come back talking about a white partner from down there.
I get so tired of fighting, Emily said.
Philomène clucked her tongue softly.
You fight just by drawing breath and sitting on your own property on confined bayou. The important thing now is the battles you choose. The one that makes a difference is keeping the family together and giving the children a better chance.
She pulled a plug of tobacco from her apron pocket and shook her head thoughtfully.
Once, I thought I was bringing you into an easier time.
You did fine, Maman.
Emily smiled, a tight smile. One of their farm cats jumped into her lap, and she stroked its short, sleek fur.
I bought 10 children, and you had 5, Philomène said, lightening her tone. Bet has given me 11 grandchildren already, and from you only Angelite's 2. What are your children waiting for? All of them should have settled down to start their own families by now.
She leaned back and closed her eyes. Josephine came crying to me about you running off that dark-skinned boy from Aloha trying to court her.
Josephine understood her responsibility, Emily said primly. His people had no standing. It is better to take these things in hand before they have a chance to go too far.
Sometimes, while you wait for what you think is better, Philomen said, what is good enough slips away.
Summer gave way to fall, and Antoine Morat was named administrator for Joseph's estate while the case dragged on. He came one windy Saturday afternoon to Cornfine Bayou to give them fresh news of the trial, pulling a small sack of salt out of his saddlebag as a gift.
They were all home and assembled in the front room. Only Suzette was absent, napping. As Josephine served tea cakes and coffee, Antoine began to complain.
The Grandchamps have the money from the estate tied up. Madame Lola's relations have more interest in her dead than when she was alive, fighting us every step of the way. But I'm looking out for you.
A small martyr's smile played at Antoine's lips, and Emily waited for the real purpose of his call.
There are many hardships in the duties of administrator, but justice triumphs in the end,